A copy of a secret memo on national security issues has recently come into our hands, and we thought we should bring it to your attention. It tells national security elites how to keep the public from balking at endless wars and at the endless costs of the military-industrial complex. Well, actually, we're publishing it as a book, so it's not so secret. And oh, by the way, the book is actually a satire. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Conversations, where today we will talk with the authors of the satirical book, that is, The Secret Memo. So let me welcome my guest today. First of all, Dr. Christopher Coyne of George Mason University, one of the co-authors. Welcome, Chris Coyne.
Thank you, Graham. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to see you. Christopher Coyne is a senior fellow with the Independent Institute here in California. He's also the co-editor of our journal, The Independent Review, and also a professor of economics at George Mason University. He's the co-editor of the Review of Austrian Economics, and he's published a lot of really interesting books. 2 years ago with us, he published this fabulous book called In Search of Monsters to Destroy, which is all about American military empire, worth a read. Also, this interesting title I noticed again on your bio, Chris. Manufacturing Militarism, U.S. Government Propaganda in the War on Terror, which you co-authored with our other guest, who is Dr. Abigail Hall. Welcome, Abby.
Thanks, Graham.
It's great to see you. Abigail Hall is an associate professor of economics at the University of Tampa, senior fellow here at the Independent Institute, author of many scholarly articles in places like the Independent Review and the Journal of Austrian Economics. So glad to have you, Abigail Hall. So this book today that we're looking at is called How to Run Wars, a confidential playbook for the national security elite. This book is available, well, almost now. You can pre-order it now if you're watching, or later on it'll just be available on our website and on Amazon. And hey, this is a pretty wild book because, I mean, even the cover of it, top secret. But actually, I think that the two of you are writing this in a tradition that precedes you. You didn't dream up the basic concept out of thin air. Tell me the genesis.
Well, the genesis of the book is severalfold. One is that satire as a writing style, of course, is a long history by many different writers of many different backgrounds. Mark Twain, for instance, one of the most famous satirical writers in American history. But also, of course, famous economists like Frederick Bastiat. And these type of authors used satire.
Oh, Jonathan Swift. Yeah. Don't forget him. Yeah.
And, you know, these authors use satire as a way to ask readers and to push readers to reflect upon and look in the mirror regarding very important social, political, economic issues, and to point out some of the tensions, if not absurdities, of those positions. And the impetus behind this specific book is a earlier book written by an economist, Bruce Wittenwright. It was published in the 1930s, and it was called How to Run a War. And you can see the parallel, of course, with our title and his. Mm-hmm. And what Knight did in that book was to reflect upon war making. He was talking about the First World War and what had been involved to win that war, to again get readers to reflect upon and think about what war making requires. And so Abby and I joined together. As you mentioned, this is our recent of many books and other academic projects to join forces to try to leverage that style of writing in order to bring these ideas up to date, but also again, ask the reader to think about and reflect upon what war making entails.
So, Abigail, this book is directed, as it were, to the national security elite, and you use that term repeatedly in the book. But I wonder, can you tell us, who are these people?
So, in the broadest sense, the national security elite would comprise individuals in both the public and the private sector who are responsible for the preparations for and execution of U.S. foreign policy up to and including war. So we could be talking about elected officials, we could be talking about unelected officials in the forms of bureaucrats, but also individuals within the private sector who are responsible for various aspects of the national security state.
And also, could it also be sort of people in think tanks or whatever in Washington, D.C., who also weigh in on these kind of things?
Depending on how we want to construe that term, it can be very, very broad. And one of the things that I think we want to highlight within this scope is exactly how many individuals are potentially involved within this this apparatus of our government, and exactly how far that extends, and exactly where and how pervasive the national security state actually is.
I get the feeling from reading the book that you really don't need to narrow the meaning too tightly, because the people involved in these things, whether they hold decision-making roles in the bureaucracy or in the military, whether it's the Secretary of State or others, or whether they're in the military supply industries or commenters and so forth, they all kind of have a common mindset and a common interest. Have I got that right?
Yes, certainly, certainly. So as Abby said, it's a catch-all term. And of course, it harkens back to a sociologist by the name of C. Wright Mills, who wrote a book called The Power Elite, which I believe was published originally in the 1950s. And the power elite for Mills are the people in society. And that can be, as Abby correctly noted, those in the public sector, private sector, or in nonprofits like think tanks that influence, implement, and carry out policies. And the national security category are the people involved in that. And so all of those various parties are involved to varying degrees. But as you noted, I think accurately, the common theme is they have an interest in designing and carrying out war making and preparation for war making under the guise of national security. And then what we need to think about critically is what that actually entails in practice. And that's really the motivation behind the project.
Yeah, Abby, are we just speaking about maybe a few bad actors in an otherwise well-intentioned group of people?
No, that's a really good question, and frequently something that you will hear is, well, if we only had the right people in these positions of authority, then things would be different. But what we're really highlighting here is that it's not a matter of a few bad people or a few bad apples, but instead it's the institutional environment in which these various actors are operating, and really their basis for what they view as being the appropriate space for U.S. foreign policy, which is ultimately driving what we've seen both historically as well as contemporarily. And so what we need to focus on is something that is more institution forward. It's not necessarily the players in the game that we're talking about.
Although you've addressed the book to the players.
Sure. Yeah. So it's the players of the game who
right.
we're talking to. But we miss really, really critical pieces of information if we don't understand the institutional environment or the game that the players are playing.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm looking at the book, I'm struck by the interesting parallels with other war phenomena things. Like, for example, there's been the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on poverty in the 60s. President Carter was famous for giving that speech during the energy crisis on the moral equivalent of war. Which was kind of a way of just submitting to energy scarcity when it turned out not to really be necessary. More recently, you know, there's been like the Guardian and Politico and others have called for a war on climate change. And what strikes me is that every time you frame something as a war, well, in a war, whether it's literal or otherwise, a war means like the regular rules don't apply, right? And so when you paint your own role as in charge of a war, then you're liberating yourself from constraints. And that's, I think, what I'm seeing examples of in
Is
your
that
book.
Right?
Is that right?
Certainly. You know, as I was listening to you speak and go through all those wars, I wonder if the right question is what aren't we at war with
right,
in the world
exactly.
today? That might be the more appropriate question as that list. And there's more, but that list that you put forward.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, our colleague Robert Higgs wrote a variety of books, especially A Crisis in Leviathan,
right.
pointing out that every time there's a crisis, well, war, what could be a bigger crisis than war, right? Every time there's a crisis or a war, the power of government has to expand, apparently, in an endless ratchet upwards. And war is like the greatest lever you can pull to get yourself more power. kind of frightening. I mean, sometimes it might be necessary, but boy, it seems like there's a real built-in, what do they call it, a moral hazard in framing yourself as in charge of a war.
Yes, certainly. So as you correctly noted, it suggests that the rules don't apply, but also that it calls forth a massive concentration of resources, a massive concentration of unity, and a demand for unity among the populace. And of course, as Bob Higgs pointed out, who's been a huge influence on myself and Abby as well, is it also concentrates an enormous amount of discretionary decision-making power in the hands of a small group of people, which is the great fear, of course, with government. I mean, the fundamental paradox of government that political philosophers have noted for centuries is any government strong enough to protect your person and property is going to be strong enough to violate, if not destroy, those very things. And so how can you, if it's possible, can you simultaneously empower and shackle Leviathan? And of course, war making automatically pushes beyond any shackles that are in place. It's the very idea of a crisis situation or emergency powers. And so at a minimum, you would hope, and this is one of the things Abby and I hope, is that readers will walk away from this rethinking kind of the vision of war making that we are spoon-fed from a young age, which is that it's a part of life, and government needs to protect us. Whereas an alternative is that certainly there might very well be instances of violence or the threat thereof. So we don't pretend that those things don't exist,
right.
But war making should be not the norm. It should be an outlier, an extreme rarity, and that should be the default position rather than the way it is now, which is war making is the norm, and then we don't even really ask questions about it, or when we do, they are questions on the margin. You know, should we send $100 million or $120 million? And should we send it this week or next week? Or what weapons should we send abroad?
Right.
But very rarely do people question the enterprise itself. And that's what we're pushing people to hopefully think about.
I noticed that it's important, apparently, for these national security elites to justify their own role in this whole enterprise, to frame the way people think about it. You call that, Abby, I guess, controlling the narrative, right? You know, you gave me a detail that I was unaware of. Apparently, and you can comment on this, Abby, I guess, at some detail if you want, but the NFL and Major League Baseball, and even apparently the bull riders, Professional Bull Rider Association, they get money paid to them by the Department of Defense so that there can be things featured at their events. What's that all about?
Yes. So one of the first things that we talk about in this playbook is this need to control the narrative, because ultimately, in order for a foreign policy to be successful or to be able to carry out a foreign policy, requires the support of, or at least the acquiescence of, the broader population in order to go out and do whatever kind of policy people are interested in carrying out. And so one of the things that we discuss is that cultivating or crafting and then delivering the chosen narrative is particularly important. And we highlight, not only in this chapter, but throughout the book, a variety of different examples, both historical as well as more contemporary, of how it is that government, or the U.S. government, has done that. And one of those examples that you mentioned is what's referred to as the phenomenon of paid patriotism, otherwise known as propaganda. And so
I'm thinking of product placements. You know how companies pay extra for their things to be featured?
Yes, except generally, and this is, I think, the critical difference, is if I'm watching a television show and I notice cans of Pepsi with the label conveniently turned to the camera, I have a pretty good idea that Pepsi has paid for product placement.
Right.
Now, what people are likely not aware of is when they go to an NFL game, an NHL game, or as you mentioned, the Professional Bull Riders Association, NASCAR, Major League Soccer, Major League Baseball, we're noticing a theme, that the Department of Defense has often partnered with these professional organizations to engage in very explicit patriotic displays. So things like members of the National Guard singing the national anthem, surprise homecomings or full field flag displays. Those types of things, which are generally interpreted as being genuine displays of patriotism and support, are actually being bought and paid for by the Department of Defense.
I mean, they could have those things without the government subsidizing and paying for them if NASCAR wanted to, right?
See, they could. One of the things, and there's documentation, and you have like NFL personnel on record saying things like, we do a couple of things really, really well. We are really good at football, and we're really good at draping ourselves in the flag. And so not only do they potentially get a monetary payoff too, but there is this really interesting historical and contemporary marriage between sport and the Department of Defense broadly. And so this relationship over time has really grown and then been used as a way to help convey these narratives. And this is something we've especially seen within the context of the war on terror, but it actually has a history that's much longer than that.
So if I'm a regular beer drinking guy at a NASCAR event and there's a patriotic display, I'm gonna like it, but I'm not thinking about the fact that it's being paid for out of my tax dollars.
Right, or you're not thinking about, again, what type of message that's being conveyed. And so here and elsewhere, we talk about the function of that, where you start to then equate things like war making with things like a game. So you look at the language that we use and say, you know, football, like bombs and blitzes and red zones and all of those types of things have their origin in talking about war and conflict. And so you not only normalize that type of language, but then you also see things like the collapse of really complicated, say, foreign policy issues to things like a football game, where there's their team and our team. There's winners and losers. It's very black and white. There's no room for dissension. There's no room for those critical shades of gray. And so this is one of the many ways that we discuss in which government has successfully crafted and then delivered those set upon narratives.
Historical precedent you mentioned was during World War II, the Office of War Information under FDR, which actually created guidelines to try and control Hollywood productions and so forth, which actually, when I read about that, I thought, well, okay, this kind of actually fits, because FDR and his administration were actually loaded with people who were either socialists or very socialist oriented, supportive of the concentrated power of the state. And, you know, this was a natural extension of that approach, it seems to me, justified now and then by war conditions. And you also mentioned how Karl Rove, on behalf of President Bush, during, I guess, the Iraq and Afghan wars, met with CBS and NBC to try and get them to, you know, do whatever, say the right thing about the war, I guess.
Right. Film and television are other ways in which we see this narrative being delivered. So you mentioned the Office of War Information, which provided very explicit guidelines to film and television studios about how World War II was supposed to be portrayed in those formats. Now, it's maybe not as explicit, but that doesn't mean that there is not influence. And so one of the things that we discuss in terms of television and film is the following type of dynamic. Let's say that I am Warner Brothers or I'm some other film studio and I'd like to make a film about the war on terror. Well, what kinds of things do I need to do that? I'm going to need military equipment. It'd be really helpful if I had space. It'd be really helpful if I maybe had military personnel. How might I get those things? They're very expensive. I can request assistance from the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense may very well offer me those things at a very reduced price or, depending on the circumstances, maybe free of charge. But there is a cost to that. And the cost is a say in the editorial process. And so what we have is a lot of examples of film studios who might send a script to the Department of Defense and they'll say, yes, we'll give you what it is that you're asking for, but we really don't like this character or we really don't like this plot line. And so we'll give you this equipment, but we'd really like it if you change this particular thing. And when it comes to making a film that might be profitable or unprofitable, if you don't have those things that the DoD is offering, the incentive is to comply. And so then you think about the implications of that. What kinds of products then are going to be produced? and what kinds of products are people going to be consuming? And what messages do they contain? It's not impossible, but that makes it then very, very difficult, or much more difficult, to produce something that might have a thoughtful or a critical message about U.S. foreign policy.
I can't help but thinking of a sort of a weird parallel, but more recently, during what I will call the war on COVID, the federal government, in both the current and the previous presidential administration, leaned on social media companies to make sure that the right messaging went out on, you know, different things, especially on COVID vaccines and so forth, and to fight disinformation by telling Facebook, you know, oh, you really wouldn't really want to put this. These things all seem to be of a piece. Isn't that weird? Or maybe not.
Yeah, we dedicate time to the book as well, of talking about various ways to potentially utilize social media to help, again, to disseminate your narrative.
Yeah.
So we talk about Facebook, we talk about X or Twitter, and the example that you mentioned explicitly of COVID, we actually go into some detail about ways in which various presidential administrations attempted to use those platforms with varying degrees of success.
Yes.
To effectively shape or change the narratives that were available to the public.
Well, Chris, one of the reasons that the U.S. deploys its military power typically is said to be to defend liberty. Amongst our liberties that we prize here are economic liberty. And so I guess a lot of the wars have been for the sake of capitalism. But when I read your book, I realized even more, I mean, I kind of thought about it, but I realized even more that the whole military enterprise turns out to be sort of anti-capitalist. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, the idea is relatively straightforward at its foundation, which is that in order to operate any military sector, but of course, certainly an expansive military sector and national security apparatus, meaning that as you increase the scope of activities you undertake, not just domestically, but internationally, and call that being the world's policeman or whatever language you want to use, that requires a significant amount of resources to operate. That's the straightforward part. Then the question, of course, is where do those resources come from and how are they marshaled? And of course, the resources come from the private sector, because government by design is a nonprofit entity. It doesn't generate any kind of profit or resources unto itself. It extracts them in a parasitic manner from the private sector. And the more resources that are needed to operate that apparatus, the national security apparatus, the more you need to pull out. And that then requires someone to do the pulling out, someone to oversee that process and then to allocate resources. And of course, the people that do that are part of the national security elite. They are the economic planners. And what does that sound like? Well, it certainly sounds like to us a variant of economic socialism.
Well, yeah, it's a command economy,
yes,
to the max.
That's exactly right. And during the World Wars, and especially during World War II, of course, this way of thinking came to the forefront. And so you actually had nationalization over certain capital goods because the government had to pull people into service. Of course, you had conscription. You had rationing over basic items, whether it's rubber, nylon, and so on. You had talking about propaganda, there was a massive propaganda campaign to literally return to the most rudimentary stages of economic development, which is growing your own food. Of course, that was called victory gardens. And so you can find propaganda posters about victory gardens, that you should grow your own food if you truly are a patriot and care about your fellow human beings and the soldiers. And of course, if you don't do that, you're an enemy of those things. And better example of the economic costs and devastating consequences than literally asking people to undermine the division of labor, peaceful social cooperation, and economic freedom to produce,
right,
your own food. Now, of course, today, because the way wars have emerged, because of technology, if you want to call it the efficiency of war, perhaps, efficiency here, of course, not in the way we talk about in the economic sense, which is value added and wealth creating. Wars is wealth destroying as a activity. the government doesn't have to marshal as many resources all at once. Of course, that could change. If there's World War III, that might very well change. But if you look at wars since World War II, of course, with ebbs and flows, the amount of resources that has taken, the concentration that's taken place at any single point in time certainly has not matched World War II. But we shouldn't take this to be evidence that the nature of war making has changed. Because one of the things that came out of World War II was what's called a permanent war economy, which was the argument was, well, look, this was so bad, and now we, the United States government, is the world's global police. We need to continually prepare for wars that aren't even on our radar yet. We can't wait for war to happen in order to ramp up production like during the world wars. We need to prepare in the here and now. And in order to do that, we need to have a permanent defense industrial base that is constantly preparing for future wars. And of course, that creates a whole host of perverse incentives, but it also institutionalized the planning apparatus that exists to this very day. And so one of the perhaps ironies, a sad irony to my way of thinking, of this entire endeavor is the grand promise is that the national security apparatus is going to protect freedoms. It's going to uphold liberal values. It's going to uphold the values and institutions that underpin free market capitalism. But as one economist by the name of Kenneth Boulding once put it in testimony before Congress, the military sector is an economic cancer. It is a parasitic entity that latches on to value-added productive economic activity. And of course, as long as that productive activity continues to outproduce the parasitic nature of it, the system can sustain. But that parasite still exists, and it threatens the very thing it purports to protect.
Well, there are some other little details I want to come back to, but you've really put your finger on the heart of the matter, clearly. And so, to anticipate objections, you know, in response to what you just said, some people, curious people, I'm curious, were likely to ask you a question like this. So, are you saying that they're never going to be a threat that requires massive military preparedness or response? Are you saying that there's never going to be terror attacks that we need to prepare for, and that North Korea is never going to launch a missile attack, and so we don't need to spend this money because nothing bad will ever happen?
We're certainly not saying that. I think counter to that, if I can speak on behalf of Abby as well, certainly threats exist all around us, every single day of our life, domestically and internationally. So the argument isn't that if we close our eyes and wish hard enough, if we sing kumbaya loud enough, that all of a sudden all threats will go away. The argument is several-fold and nuanced. One aspect of it is this, that certainly there are external threats, but it is quite possible that in transferring enormous amounts of power and resources to the national government in the name of potentially offsetting these threats, you are creating a threat unto itself. Again, this is the classic challenge of who's going to watch the watchman, or if the fox is guarding the hen house, who's going to guard the fox? Because the fox can slaughter the hens. And then what are they going to do? Of course, the other issue externally is that ramping up military spending, pounding your chest, talking tough, deploying armaments around the world can be argued to actually increase the chances of violent conflict. Because when you normalize militarism and all that is entangled within that as a means of social interaction between human beings, as a means of navigating conflict, then others are going to respond in kind, and not just in terms of necessarily building up armaments, but using them, which is the other element of this. Government bureaus justify their existence by doing things. That is how they justify their current budgets and get more budgets.
Yeah, and in the case of national security stuff, it's not just they justify their own existence, they justify the whole related network of evaluators, commentators, producers, and so forth, who have to justify their existence.
Exactly. And so one has to reflect upon and wonder, once all these things exist, how likely is it that they will, and when I say these things, I mean all of the various aspects of the military sector, from bombs and tanks and guns to the intelligence apparatus to all else that is entangled with this, how likely is it that they are just going to sit idle, that they won't be proactively used?
And
the challenge, of course, is that because there's potential threats all around the world, when those things exist, those threats are going to get inflated so that they can be utilized and deployed.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're saying that sometimes, at least, a advanced hawkish posture of our military may trigger some of the very problems that they're aimed to resist.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we discuss in this book is the idea of tripwires, is that when you are so incredibly involved in a variety of different places, then that really creates a variety of different opportunities for problems. So if you are militarily involved here and there and over there and over here, then something that happens in one of those places, which may not actually involve you directly as a state or have any real implications for the U.S. public, suddenly become an area of focus for the U.S. government.
Well, by design, that's the point of a tripwire.
Right. And to add on a bit to what Chris mentioned a moment ago in terms of the pushback, which is, again, this idea that, you know, the U.S. government is the source of order for the globe. I would really hope that one of the things that our book would do is to get people to question that as an assumption. And one of the things that I know when presenting these types of ideas in any format is that the pushback is exactly one of the things that you brought up, which is, well, there are all of these threats that are everywhere. But one of the things that we highlight throughout this book and elsewhere is that there are a lot of costs to engaging in these types of policies. And these costs are long, they're variable, so we might not see them right away, but that doesn't mean that those costs are insignificant. Those costs are incurred by us today. They're incurred by future domestic citizens who either can't vote yet, or many of them, frankly, aren't even born yet, and also a variety of different individuals abroad. And so one of the things that I think Chris and I are both interested in is getting people to really maybe flip or change the way that they consider U.S. foreign policy, because the dominant narrative now is something has to be done, and that
right.
something mm-hmm. is often through military activity. But the bar for military activity should be remarkably high. Because as Chris mentioned earlier with his example of trying to get people to grow victory gardens, so basically going back to, you know, small-scale subsistence farming, is war is one of the, perhaps the most destructive thing that human beings can do to each other. And so the fact that that seems to be the default position for so many individuals to say we should use the military, we should use military force, at least in my mind, really has it patently backward. That should be the last resort. It shouldn't be the primary emphasis of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, that's why, I suppose, in the U.S. constitutional document, war making has a very high threshold of approval. Congress has to declare war, and the president can't initiate war, at least constitutionally. The constitutional founders apparently agreed with you in that respect, at least, a high threshold of justification for all-out military violence. So stepping back half a step, if I may, tripwires. I never heard of Tower 22 before. I didn't even know there was a Tower 22. And apparently there's a bunch of things like it. Tell our friends what Tower 22 is, please, Abby.
So Tower 22 is something that we discuss within the last chapter of the book, and yet again is one of those examples of those types of tripwires that we were talking about, where you have an attack on a military base or on a group of individuals or a place that is affiliated with the U.S. military. And then the response to that or the desired response, or the response that's called for, is one that is a military action. And so yet again, just one of those examples of a tripwire.
So it's in northeast Jordan, I think.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And this was in the news recently because a drone strike hit it and injured U.S. soldiers, which is why the only reason it was in the news in America, in American newspapers. Of course, the reason this exists is because it gives the United States government access to it's a focal point with access to surrounding areas. So combating ISIS in Iraq.
So it's supposed to be a way of sort of fending off or advance prevention of military difficulties, but it actually invites military difficulties.
That's right, right. And it's not even heading off difficulties. What it is doing is it's the logical outcome of policing the world, which is as you expand the portfolio of activities. I mean, think about this just in any other walk of life. If you run a business or a nonprofit and you take on additional activities, those additional activities need to be managed, overseen, executed. You have to deal with problems, put out fires constantly. It's the same thing with intervening around the world. The difference being, of course, when you run a business or a nonprofit, we're not talking about weapons and maiming and harming people. We're talking about running a private organization. And so the very existence of the base is a result of meddling around the world. And of course, then that gets attacked. Then you need to respond to that. And it's a never-ending cycle. It's analogous to you know, the game people play as a kid, whack-a-mole, you know, where you whack one mole popping up over here and two more pop up over here.
I loved that game.
Yeah. Well, it's great when you're playing in an arcade, not so much with the lives of soldiers and other people around the world, perhaps.
Yeah, not when the moles are actual people.
Yeah, exactly. In your book, at one point, you make this very provocative piece of advice to the national security types. You say, we could not have dreamed up a better scenario than a provoked Russia now on the march to justify even more military expenditure and the exploitation of any occasion to use our new, more powerful weapons. Huh. So a provoked Russia, that's a pretty powerful little phrase. It reminds me of something I heard, I think it was last year, at a kind of libertarian-oriented conference where the speaker was arguing for massive further U.S. military investment to protect Ukraine, because the speaker said, we've got to invest our military and push it forward in Ukraine, because otherwise Ukrainians won't have the freedom to make their own personal choices about whether to go to church or to a bar or wherever. It was all about, like, bombs for liberty. And you're saying that a provoked Russia is actually maybe something that the security elite would like because it justifies their power. But if it's just provoked, maybe it's not necessary to send all that military equipment to Ukraine. Is that what you're implying?
So I think about what we mean by that phrase is, again, talking about this, getting the public, again, to go along with policy, to be a driver for more intervention or the buildup for intervention. So earlier we mentioned Bob Higgs and his work. And one of the things within to the book I'm thinking about is Crisis and Leviathan, is he talks about and highlights the importance of crisis as a means of expanding the scale and scope of government. That crisis can be real or perceived, but what happens is the following. There's some crisis, and then there is this kind of natural tendency for people to want the government to do something to fix the crisis. And so what we're referring to here in talking about a provoked Russia or China or North Korea or whoever it might be, is if people are perceiving that as being a true threat, then they will want government to do something, or government will have an easier time with the sales pitch of, hey, this is a threat. We need to do something. We need to expand. We need to engage in more military operations abroad. We need to do this at home or that at home. And so that's what we're talking about within that particular passage.
So this is a call, implicitly, it's a call for a much more careful multivariate cost-benefit analysis on these things that doesn't just look myopically at one thing. And you seem to be implying that maybe not every injustice in the world is the appropriate occasion for a U.S. military force to be deployed.
That's correct. It's not every injustice in the world, and it is possible that in attempting to address a perceived injustice, you actually may create even a greater injustice in the present or the future. And so that's one of the costs, a hidden cost, which is what if the supposed remedy is worse than the illness? Which again, people on both sides of the ideological aisle are quite cognizant of in many domestic programs. But for some reason, internationally, this logic flies out the window, while perhaps the logic should be extended even more so, given the scale and scope of government, the number of players involved, the number of interest groups, and so on. And so if you start thinking about the national security sector as a large-scale, all-encompassing government program, how would
it is
exactly how it's not, there's nothing special or unique about it. There are unique features about it, but there's nothing unique about it from the perspective of the United States government runs a host, both at the national and state levels, of domestic programs. And so too do they run international programs. And so the tools are equally applicable to them. And then, of course, where that leads you is up for debate. And of course, as you noted, a nuanced cost-benefit analysis, but it's extremely nuanced because a lot of these costs and benefits are unseen. At the best
right.
we have is patterns, meaning we can expect general tendencies. But that, if anything, is perhaps reason for pause. Again, so many of these discussions take place as if there's certainty. There's certainty both in the diagnosed problem and in the proposed solution. But what happens once we introduce severe uncertainty along with all of the other pathologies of an enormous centralized government, and we think through that logically?
It sounds like, in your analysis, that military risk or threat, international threat, is one of those situations where it's not always obvious exactly what should be done, and there should be a lot more modesty and minimalism in the use of American military power. The analysis also, again, it's ringing, you know, various bells in my head. People who don't like big government should be really asking hard questions about this biggest piece of big government. And similarly, it rings the bell that during the COVID crisis, many people pointed out that federal health officials were myopically focused on what can be done to save, you know, X number of lives from COVID, not thinking about how their comprehensive solutions and mandates actually jeopardized lives, deferred medical care, jeopardized future of marginalized children who were taken out of school, will never recover, massive economic dislocation. They were only thinking of one variation in what really should have been a multivariate analysis. And that's always the case in government decision-making because power is so seductive. Let's use all of it now to solve this problem. But really, there's so many unexpected, unintended, or maybe occasionally intended consequences.
Yeah, one of the things that we discuss here and elsewhere is that when you are engaged in a top-down policy plan, so whether that is talking about COVID or whether that is talking about military intervention, it necessarily requires the imposition of a uniform set of goals on everyone else. And so it eliminates the kind of nuance that you're talking about or this debate or the ability to try different alternatives or different solutions to various problems. And as you carefully and I think correctly highlight, and we do here as well, is that there are really significant costs for that. But there does appear to be something kind of an interesting phenomenon, and Chris and I have talked about this, but you brought it up, so I'll mention it, is that even for people who are remarkably skeptical of government intervention in other capacities, they seem to sidestep or to grant some kind of almost magical power to the national security state. So if you talk to someone who is very skeptical of, let's say, the Department of Motor Vehicles, because they recognize all of the perverse bureaucratic incentives inherent within that bureau, those bureaucratic incentives are also inherent within the U.S. military and the Department of Defense, but they're even more pronounced. And yet a lot of times people seem to not want to make those particular connections. And so one of the things that we're hoping that people will take away from this book is that those same types of pathologies that people are aware of and highly skeptical of in other contexts are not only present here, but in many cases, even more pronounced than they are in other contexts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more pronounced. And you're being pretty daring here, because you're not just saying the Department of Defense spends too much on toilet seats and wrenches. You're actually talking about fundamental questions of to what degree the U.S. military should be involved around the world. These are tough questions, you know. At the very least, for someone like myself, I consider myself very much a profound patriot. I really wonder, on the basis of what you said, and of course a lot of other information, whether maybe some more careful, balanced cost-benefit analysis is really maybe necessary in ways that I never thought of. So thank you for broadening my own thinking. Appreciate that. And so, you know, looking at the big picture here, I think that maybe not all the people involved in national security decision-making are as craven and self-interested as, you know, the satire might portray them to be. But I think that they should be grateful to you and should read the book, because it'll give them some reason for self-doubt and self-questioning that might do a considerable amount of good among national security elite decision makers. I'm sure that must be what you had in mind, right?
Well, I hope so. And I hope they read the whole thing, because if they stop before the end, they might take it as a serious guide and try to implement it, which might be
please not
problematic.
That.
Yes, that's not the intention. But certainly, and I should mention, you know, based on one of the comments you made, the analysis and study of these things, and it's certainly not our intention, it doesn't require an assumption or accusation of malevolent behavior on the part of people involved. That's certainly possible, of course, like in any walk of life. But as Abby stated earlier, it's really an institutional point, which is once you have a government apparatus set up and you have certain goals that are attributed to the operation of that apparatus, it incentivizes a certain type of behavior. So if you think about just a simple thought experiment, an apparatus that purely focused on defense, meaning that not outside of our borders, our national borders. So this goes back to your point about external threats. You know, let's say there's an external threat of someone attacking the United States. Well, one way to deal with that is to protect our borders. Another is to go abroad in search of monsters in order to proactively destroy people. But once you start doing that, then the entire globe becomes a battlefield. Those different ways of perceiving the problem have dramatically different implications, and they put enormous responsibilities and pressures and obligations on the people running them. When you have the vision of going around the world to proactively shape things, manipulate things, and so on, that's going to attract a certain type of person. It has to, in order for the project to be carried out. And so that's what we mean. It's not so much everyone in this sector is either good or bad or somewhere in between. It's that the very nature of the enterprise itself incentivizes and necessitates certain types of behavior, which are often unbecoming, to put it charitably.
A systemic self-interest with unintended consequences might be one way of summarizing the phenomenon that you describe. Abby, and comment from you?
Sure. And I just, because it was something that you mentioned, Graham, about feeling and being a patriotic person and this idea of questioning the military. And this is something, too, that comes up a lot. And earlier we talked about the NFL and sports and their relationship with the Department of Defense.
A financial relationship.
But within that, and one of the things that we discuss in that particular chapter, but also elsewhere, is that then the what this is what happens in that dynamic. There's a conflation between, say, being a good sports fan and a good American. You can be a patriotic person and love your country and like the ideals that your country was founded upon.
That's me.
Yeah, and be and still be inherently skeptical of the policies that government officials are carrying out. And so in some capacities, I know that people have used this label for me, and I'm going to go out on a limb and assume for Chris as well. Like, you must hate the United States, like the most unpatriotic people ever. And in my mind, that's not the case at all. In fact, if you are truly interested in the ideals of quote-unquote American society or the American founders, then these types of questions should be critically important. And they're things that are necessary because in order for democracies to function, people have to be actively engaged. And so this here, one of the things that we are, again, hoping people will take away is that we have to be engaged citizens. There is a price to liberty, and that price is being vigilant. That price is asking questions, and that price is pushing back upon kind of standard narratives when those standard narratives are potentially wrong and, at least in my mind, inherently destructive.
I am thinking of Lord Acton's famous saying, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. There is no greater power than the military power deploying of violence. So got to be skeptical. I think you're calling for a rational patriotism, which I really appreciate. If I had the time, and maybe you'll have opportunity later, but I would like going to go through 5 or 6 or 7 concrete instances of, you know, foreign affairs threat and how it could be dealt with and so forth. But time does not permit right now. For the moment, I just want to thank you very much, Abigail Hall and Christopher Coyne, for coming up with this crazy but fascinating book, How to Run Wars, a playbook for the national security elite. And encourage our friends to take a look at it and read it all the way through. And if you know people who, in fact, make their living by being part of that, then you ought to buy it to them, buy it for them for a gift. Don't you think?
I would very much like that.
Definitely be a conversation starter. Highly recommend right before Thanksgiving.
There you go. There you go. Okay. Many thanks to both of you. Thank you to all of our friends who join us for Independent Conversations. Remember, of course, that you can not only find this book, but get a lot of other very useful information by visiting our website, independent.org, where we try to provide you with some well-researched alternatives to some of the prevailing opinions of the day. And so that's the tradition in which both Chris Coyne and Abby Hall stand. Thank you both very much. Join us again next time. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.